Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I've had a great pleasure on 2 previous occasions of speaking with best-selling author Peter Stark. The first opportunity to speak with him was about a really terrific book called At the Mercy of the River, in which he wrote about his own real-life adventure of probing through a largely unexplored river, I believe, in the heart of Africa. Am I remembering that correctly? Yeah, that.
Yes, you are, in Mozambique. Yeah.
That was many, many years ago, but I really loved the book and loved our conversation. And then more recently, we talked about his book, Astoria, which talks about how, for a time, it looked as though the northwestern portion of America might end up being its own country of Astoria. And, of course, it is indeed part of the United States now, but it was not always a foregone conclusion that that's what was going to happen. His most recent book reshapes our understanding of our first president, George Washington. And I should say maybe it reshapes our understanding of who George Washington was before he became the George Washington who is on Mount Rushmore and pictured on the dollar bill and first in the hearts of all of his countrymen. Young George Washington was a very different person. And it was, in many respects, the experience that he had in the wilderness during the French and Indian War that George Washington was sort of shaped into at least something resembling the heroic and inspiring figure that he was to become. That's the contention of Peter Stark, anyway, and his meticulously researched and beautifully written book is a portrait of what George Washington was in these earlier years. Not his childhood, but as a young adult. And it is a portrait that may be a little bit disconcerting if you prefer to think of the father of our country only in sort of the grandest and holiest of terms, then you have to hang on to your hat because your sense of who George Washington was is likely to be shaken. But I, for one, found this book to be absolutely riveting and most revelatory. Again, it's called Young Washington, How Wilderness and War Forged America's Founding Father. And it's published by Echo, a division of HarperCollins. Peter Stark, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg. And I'm really pleased to be here. And you've got a great memory for my earlier books, maybe better than my own memory for my earlier books. And a really good summary of young Washington. So it's great to speak with you again.
It's interesting. When I first saw this book, when it first arrived in the mail, I thought to myself, because I especially think of you in terms of that very first book, At the Mercy of the River, because that was my introduction to you. And so I think, well, what is the author of At the Mercy of the River doing writing a book about George Washington? And, of course, the interesting tie between the two is the way in which you are, in some respects, I've seen you described as a wilderness writer, someone who is intrigued by the wilderness and what happens to a person when they explore a wilderness. Is that the most powerful connection to draw here?
Yes, exactly. You hit it right on the nail on the head. I come at writing myself, having actually grown up in Wisconsin and paddled a great deal in Wisconsin and skied a great deal there. From an adventurous background, and always been interested in outdoor adventure and travel to difficult places and the wilderness in specific. And I'm really fascinated by the way the wilderness affects people who are exposed to this situation where they don't have the control they have in their normal lives, and they're subject to forces much greater than themselves, and how they react to that. And so, as you were saying, the book we first talked about, At the Mercy of the River, about this expedition, a paddling expedition on a river, and really an unpaddled river in a remote part of Africa, was just about that very thing, and how the wilderness affected me in that case, and how it had affected European explorers in centuries past, the African wilderness. And then the previous book, Astoria, same thing, a huge expedition sent by John Jacob Astor, a big New York fur baron, across the continent. This is just a few years after Lewis and Clark, to establish the first American trade colony on the West Coast. And that the wilderness profoundly affected those people. I mean, some went crazy, some thrived, some didn't. And so that's how I came at this Young Washington book, from really that very same angle. It wasn't because I necessarily wanted to write a presidential biography, but because I had been in Western Pennsylvania writing about wilderness for another book some years ago, and I stumbled across the story of this young, 20-something George Washington himself stumbling through the wilderness and thrashing through the wilderness in many ways, and making lots of mistakes, and being a difficult young man in a difficult position, but eventually learning from his mistakes and from that experience, and over many years becoming the great leader that he became.
Can you tell us more about how you came across this story of young George Washington in the wilderness? I mean, exactly under what circumstances did that story first cross your path?
Well, I was writing a book, I think two books ago, called Last Empty Places. And the idea of that book, again, it's very wilderness-tied. I took a photograph of the United States at night from a NASA satellite. I obtained a NASA photo, nighttime photo of the U.S. And I spoke with a geographer friend who kind of guided me in this. And instead of looking where the lights were on that photograph, these are just the lower 48 states, not Alaska. Instead of looking where the lights were, I looked where the lights were not. I looked at the what I call the blank spaces, the dark spots in that photograph of the United States. And I focused in on those areas, and I profiled four different ones, meaning I went to these places, I traveled around, I hiked around, I paddled around, I interviewed people, I looked for stories of the early explorers who had come through, I looked for, the Native Americans who had traditionally lived in those places, and I wrote a book. And in the course of that research, one of the places I chose was Western Pennsylvania, which you don't really think of being as a wilderness, a blank spot, but it really very much is. And it's in the Appalachian Mountains, or the Allegheny Mountains, depending on how you want to call that particular range. Very rocky, rugged terrain. It never was really heavily farmed. So today it still remains quite forested and quite empty of people. So while I was hiking around in there and looking into the local history, I kept coming across references to George Washington. And I never knew he'd been out that far. This was a long way from the East Coast. And the stories were of this guy, having these incredible wilderness adventures and nearly dying a number of times, and inadvertently setting off the French and Indian War. And, he was out there for 5 years, and it really intrigued me. So I kept that story in mind. And when I'd finished the book about Astoria, the West Coast adventure, I took up this one, Young Washington. And So, yeah, here we are today. Kind of a serendipitous path through the wilderness.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Peter Stark, best-selling author, whose most recent book is called Young Washington, How Wilderness and War Forged America's Founding Father. I should think that the task of writing about this early chapter of Washington's life would be quite challenging for any historian, just because it is surely not nearly so well documented as, for instance, George Washington's exploits as commander-in-chief of the American Army or his experiences as our first president. What kind of documentation exists about this period in his life, and how much of that documentation is suspect? I mean, and the kind of documentation that a historian or somebody at least interested in history has to treat very carefully.
Well, you raise a number of good points. It's there are many challenges in that there is not as much documentary evidence as the later part of his life. But on the other hand, the documentary evidence that does exist is in some ways more revealing of Washington and his personality and his vulnerabilities, his emotions. He becomes more guarded later in his life, and he becomes more conscious of projecting an image. So in these early writings of his, and there are quite a few, you see a more human Washington, not this kind of unblemished statue that we have in our minds, you know, a kind of a Mount Rushmore-esque marble statue gazing off into posterity, you know, with a flawless judgment and sort of someone who was born a man god of some sort, you know, a great leader. He didn't become the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army until he was 43 years old. So this is period I'm writing about is 20 years before. The evidence that exists, there are a few early writings of his, you know, what they call boyhood writings, but not much. When he starts on this first big wilderness expedition at age 21, he's sent by the British governor of Virginia into the wilderness on a mission. And it's then that he starts keeping an official correspondence, and he keeps a journal, and he writes letters, and those are all kept and archived. I used that material to a great degree. I read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Washington's letters, which are not necessarily easy to read, and used that as primarily the basis of my research and his journals, and likewise letters and journals of others around him. The wonderful thing is that these are, you know, I'd like to give credit where credit's due, is that the University of Virginia has been compiling the George Washington papers for decades now. It's something like 35 volumes, and the Library of Congress has put all of that online, so it's accessible. You know, we could call it up on our cell phones right now. We could call up the George Washington letter from when he was, you know, 22 years old and, you know, stumbling through the wilderness and read it right here. So I use that a lot, those resources a lot. And then there, you know, in those days, people corresponded by letter. So there's so many letters between the participants in these stories that you can track things fairly well that way. On the other hand, there's all the what do you say, hagiography of Washington, the writings that have projected him as this great saint from, you know, the founding father, who is this sort of flawless leader, and you know, there's no denying he was a great leader, but the stories that have the mythology that swirls around him, and especially his early years, is you know, there's a lot of mythology, like the chopping down the cherry tree story, which was written by a guy named Parson Weems, who was a preacher, you know, in the late 18th century, early 19th century, and who wrote morally uplifting fables for children. And Parson Weems, the year after Washington died, wrote a biography of a supposed biography of Washington, but it contained a lot of uplifting moral fables for children, one of which was the cherry tree story, which was an invention of Parson Weems, or it might have had very tiny basis in fact, but it was wildly exaggerated. So there are all those myths, all those the mythology about Washington that one has to kind of pluck through to get to the real Washington in these years.
Right. You write in the first chapter of your book, this is not the Washington possessed of nearly superhuman virtue, who, given the chance to consolidate power and rule indefinitely over the just-born nation, willingly stepped down and returned to a quiet life on his Virginia plantation. Rather, this is the young Washington, but not the Washington of the cherry tree bedtime story. This young Washington is ambitious, temperamental, vain, thin-skinned, petulant, awkward, demanding, stubborn, annoying, hasty, passionate. This Washington has not yet learned to cultivate his image or contain his emotions. Here instead is a raw young man struggling toward maturity and in love with a close friend's wife. This is the Washington of emotional neediness, personal ambition, and mistakes, many mistakes. I wonder, as you first began exploring this period of George Washington's life, did you have any expectations that this was the portrait that would emerge of a young man with all of these sorts of flaws? I mean, as you began this, did you have a sense of where you were going to end up, or was this, in a sense, a surprising revelation to you?
Well, in some senses, it was a surprising revelation, because I went at it with the idea of following a young man in the wilderness. And the more I read about it, the more I looked at it, the more I researched it, the more I understood just how he was struggling. I knew he'd made mistakes, you know, going into it. I knew he'd made these mistakes and you know, by some interpretations, set off the French and Indian War. And I knew he was struggling for position in trying to climb the aristocracy. But it was only on reading these letters, and actually after spending a year or so reading his letters, that I really began to understand him, and I really started understanding the context of each letter and the sort of emotional background to these early letters, and plus simply decoding the language. He writes very stiffly. He has very little formal education, doesn't write very clearly, and writes in a very formal, convoluted manner. But after a while, I really started feeling, okay, I know where he's coming from right here. I know why he's writing this letter and I can see what he's feeling. It's almost like reading between the lines in some cases. And the portrait that emerged, it was, you know, wow, this guy had a lot more issues than I thought he did going into it. So, you know, sometimes, you read the letters from his boss, the British governor of Virginia, Governor Dinwiddie, and those are equally revealing, because Governor Dinwiddie is responding to the letters that young Washington is writing to him, you know, and young Washington writing to his boss, Governor Dinwiddie. And it's just, they go on. I mean, he's just like whining. He's threatening to quit time and time again. He's saying, I'm not getting paid enough. This other officer has rank over me. He shouldn't have rank over me. People are saying nasty things about my reputation down there in Williamsburg. It just goes on and on and on, these complaints. And in Governor Dinwiddie's response, you can just see him. He's, I mean, like literally figuratively rolling his eyes. It's like, oh my God, here's another letter from Washington, the young Washington. On the other hand, Washington took on amazing responsibility at a very young age. You know, by age 22, he was leading almost 1,000 men, and he was a very conscientious administrator. You know, he really tried to make things work in an administrative sense. But he was also very thin-skinned, very, very prideful, and really, really ambitious, trying to climb in the aristocracy, trying to make a name for himself, trying to, you know, protect his honor. So, yes, it was a revelation to me to see how visible these issues and problems were in this struggling young man, whom we think of as being kind of fully formed as a great leader. He wasn't at all.
We're speaking with Peter Stark, best-selling author, whose latest book is called Young Washington, How Wilderness and War Forged America's Founding Father. Do you have time for just a couple more questions?
Oh, yeah. No problem. I'm here.
Let's have you explain a little bit about what first drew young George Washington into the wilderness in the first place.
Well, I'll give you a little bit of family background and cut me off if I get going too long on it, because it's a fascinating family background that he has. It goes back several centuries. But I mean, basically, Washington came from a family, both in England and then in Virginia, that was always struggling to get up into the upper aristocracy, and with remarkable consistency not getting there. The Washington men tended to marry wealthy and very landed widows. They, acquire a lot of land through their marriage. Then they have like 18 children, and the wealth would disperse despite primogeniture, and then drop back down in status. So George Washington was born in 1732 in Virginia to a family of kind of the middling planter class. I mean, he wasn't from one of the great Virginia tobacco planting families, you know, who could have thousands of acres and hundreds of slaves and these great houses with marble halls, and the whole complex would be like a village. He wasn't from a place like that. It was more like he was from a farm. But his father was a serious planter, but his father died young when George was 11. George had several older half-brothers, and those older half-brothers inherited the land from George's father, Gus Washington. George got very little land, and George also had very little formal education, where his older half-brothers had actually been schooled in England at boarding school. George did not have that. So he had, I don't know, maybe what grade, but, you know, maybe sixth grade education, something like that. So George was, once his father died, was left without a way to make a living. And, you know, there were various things were suggested. One of his older brothers suggested that George go to sea, because the older brother had been with the British Royal Navy briefly. And George's mother, and this was when George was 14, George's mother wrote a letter to her brother in England saying, what did he think of the idea? And the brother said, they're going to use him like a dog. And don't let him go. And so his mother said, no way. And, you know, that's one of these flukes that instead of a George Washington on the sea, which might have been a very different George Washington, and we might have been a very different place as a nation, we have a George Washington on land. And at age 14 or 15, he took up his father's surveyor's instruments, his old surveyor's instruments, and he taught himself to survey. And this is, you know, here's again one of these characteristics you see in Washington, his ability to teach himself. He's very good at that and really focus on the task. He teaches himself to survey by the time he's about 15. Then he ends up going on a surveying party for part of the Fairfax family, this huge British family that has huge holdings of land in Virginia. And Washington helps this party survey part of the Virginia wilderness, kind of the edge of where the cultivation stops and the wilderness begins. And he does a good job. And by age 18, he's surveying professionally, making good money, buying his own land, trying to climb his way up, you know, kind of clawing his way up in the social standings and making a name for himself in the Virginia aristocracy. And then at age 21, he, again, to kind of boost his status, he volunteers for a part-time military position in the Virginia military. And at that point, when George is 21, the British governor of Virginia, Governor Dinwiddie, has an urgent message that he needs delivered to the French commandant of a French fort built way back in the wilderness, in the Ohio Valley wilderness. This is on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains. There's this huge chunk of wilderness that's, you know, roughly the size of France, and the French have built a fort back there. Governor Dinwiddie sends Washington on this urgent mission because Washington has some wilderness, not, you know, frontier experience. He's a young man. Washington, you know, raises his hand. I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll take this message. And Governor Dinwiddie sends him on this huge, incredible journey, hundreds of miles on horseback in the winter over the snowy Appalachian Mountains, way back into this Ohio wilderness to deliver the message to the French commandant. And the message essentially says from Governor Dinwiddie, all these lands belong to King George. Stay out. And the French officer, very distinguished gentleman, receives George with all this, you know, sort of formal hospitality way back at this fort in the wilderness, and gives him this wonderful dinner and lots of wine and, you know, it's a full-on reception, and then writes the response to Governor Dinwiddie and hands it to Washington, who then, with his wilderness guide, Christopher Gist, has this harrowing journey to get back, and it's so cold and snowy, they have to leave their horses. The horses can't get enough feed, can't get enough forage. They're on foot. They think they're being chased by Indians at one point. They essentially run through the wilderness for about a day and a half, two days straight. At one point, they come to a river that they thought would be frozen and they could walk over, and it's not. They build a makeshift raft. Washington falls off this raft in the middle of this half-frozen river among the ice floes. He almost drowns. Again, you know, we just narrowly missed losing our first president, but eventually they make it out to the coastal plantations and, you know, the much gentler coast and warmer coast deliver the letter to Governor Dinwiddie, and Governor Dinwiddie reads the letter from the French commandant and basically says, the letter says, well, our countries are at peace at the moment, and we would like to keep them at peace. However, as to your request that we leave, I don't think so. We're staying. and so this is kind of where the real trouble begins for everybody. Dinwiddie, outraged, sends Washington back into the wilderness at the head of a small military party, and he cautions Washington, be cautious and don't be the aggressor. And he's essentially, Dinwiddie's, the governor's delivering a firmer message to the French. Well, young Washington at this point now, he's 22, just turned 22 years old, leading this small military party back into the wilderness, ends up ignoring both the edict to be cautious and the one to not to be the aggressor. He comes across a party of French who are camped in a wooded glen deep in the wilderness. He sneaks up on them at dawn, on a rainy, rainy dawn, and he comes crawling over the edge of the glen, you know, muskets drawn, ready to fire. And it turns out there are a bunch of French guys down there. They're having breakfast where they're still asleep. Washington gives, it's hazy just how the events transact. It appears from the most recent testimony that's been discovered from an Iroquois warrior, documents found in the French archives recently, that Washington fired the first shot. In any case, he does order volleys fired on these French down on this glen having breakfast. He's saying, oh, they were running for their arms, ends up slaughtering a bunch of these guys. An Indian ally with Washington goes up to the French officer in charge. The officer in charge is wounded. The Indian ally goes up to him, takes his tomahawk, slams it down in the skull, splits open the skull, pulls out his brains, washes his brains through his hands, and then they scalp all the guys and take prisoners and leave. Well, at this point, you'd think of like a prudent, cautious commander might hesitate and think where to go from here. What's the next step? That didn't go exactly as planned. But Washington is very brash and very eager to make a name for himself. He starts bragging brother, oh, I heard bullets whistle, and I found something charming in their sound. He writes to Governor Dinwiddie, oh, if the French put up no more fight than this, I'll drive them back to damn Montreal. And so Washington keeps marching ahead with his little party of guys. And long story short, the result is utter disaster. They get slaughtered. Washington and his men get slaughtered. A lot of his men die. Big party of French and Indians come upon them. Washington's trying to build a kind of a makeshift little claptrap fort that doesn't really do anything at all. He has to surrender. And it's a huge humiliation for the British. You know, the British in London are outraged that this defeat has happened. You know, how could we lose a battle against these Indians and French? And these end up being the opening atrocities, aggressions in the French and Indian War, and that sets off a war that lasts for 7 years, spreads all around the globe. It becomes a huge, expensive, massive, what actually Churchill many years later called it, the first global war. America was known as the French and Indian War. In Europe and around the globe, it was known as the 7 Years War between the French and the British. So that's how Washington initially got in the wilderness.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and of course it's a story that is fraught with all kinds of missteps on his part. I guess part of the story here also is ultimately of Washington's capacity to at least eventually learn something and grow in some important ways out of these early experiences, especially out of these many mistakes he made. Can you talk a bit about kind of that process by which the Washington that is more familiar to us emerges from this turbulent first chapter?
Yes, it's really interesting how that occurs. And of course it doesn't occur all in one moment, but you can see over the years that he does begin to change and grow and expand. And I think that's you're really hitting it with that. What's most instructive about this young Washington, I mean, in a way he's very inspirational despite all his mistakes, because we see he's a very human character. He's just like any one of us, you know. All of us struggle in our own ways and or have struggled, have made mistakes. And so to see him come from this very difficult thrashing period of his life and learn and expand, that's truly inspirational for me. And I think in our age, when we're really talking about crisis of leaderships on many fronts, that it's a lesson for our age to see this process, to see Washington grow from that thrashing young man. So part of what happens is that and this is again my interpretation, because you know none of this is Washington saying, well, I changed, I'm a new person, I've shed all my own ways and I'm starting anew, but that he, as a result of some of these traumatic events. For instance, when he and his men really get slaughtered, and you know, here are the men, these young men he's leading, and he's only 22, and they're lying all around him in the rain, in the mud. They're slaughtered in these bloody, mud-filled trenches. You know, guys he's known, he's leading, and you know, it's basically he led them right into this, and there they are, his buddies lying dead. You know, that has to start developing this empathy in him. It's not just about himself, you know, it's not just about making a name for himself. And that's what you see, is that you see that arc, that he realizes, well, it's not just about me, as we put it in modern phrasing, that it's about something larger. And it's not just about my name and my reputation, because he was so focused on his name and his reputation as a young man. There's a larger cause going here. So a couple of other incidents that really push that that kind of spreading, that maturing, is that he's for almost three years, he's in charge of protecting the Virginia frontier, the frontier settlers who are out along this frontier, you know, the families that have built homesteads. And this frontier, I compare to the modern Afghanistan frontier, it's, you know, Afghanistan-Pakistan frontier. This is 350 miles long along the Appalachians, very rugged. It's wilderness. It's and it's there are all sorts of indigenous people there who know the terrain. They know the ground. They know they've lived there for centuries, and they are extremely skilled fighters and extremely crafty. And Washington keeps comparing them to foxes. And it really, it's just an impossible task to guard against these raids, these Indian raids. But Washington's charged with that task. Yet he's so ambitious that he leaves his post several times and takes a journey of 1,000 miles to Boston to petition the British general in Boston to ask for a higher rank for himself, because he feels he's being outranked by this other officer down in Virginia. And while he's gone, there are a number of Indian raids, and people really get slaughtered. And he comes back, and to families that are just slaughtered in their fields, the bodies strewn about, wild animals eating the bodies. The bodies are stuck full of scythes and axes, and then he has all these frontier settlers coming to him, George Washington, pleading with him to protect them. They're literally pleading with him. And Washington, you begin to see in his letters that he's really starts feeling this responsibility, this empathy for these people. You know, it's not just about me. This is my duty. And his sense of purpose starts spreading into a larger sphere than himself. And then a third incident that's very visible that helps him in this process is that at another point, it's a famous event, famous battle. And I won't go into all the background, but just basically the British, you know, the main British Royal Army, this is not the colonial troops, the London authorities send in the main British Royal Army, the Redcoats, 2,000 of them, led by General Braddock, to march into the wilderness and chop a road for 100 and some miles and attack the French fort way back in the wilderness. And almost predictably, they get totally ambushed by Indians and French, and they get slaughtered. I mean, just total famous defeat known as Braddock's defeat. Washington is a young aide-de-camp to Braddock in that defeat, and Washington performs really heroically in the sense that he's just fearless, and he's like the last man standing almost among the officers. You know, most officers are killed. He's the only guy delivering messages for Braddock up and down the lines. Braddock is wounded. Washington helps drag Braddock off the battlefield, and Washington survives this battle with his 4 bullet holes through his coat, through his hat, and he's yet unscathed. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dead and wounded. And as a result of that, and he writes about it almost immediately in letters, that he says, I feel that I'm being protected by divine providence, as he puts it. I'm being protected by divine providence for some larger role. And so he starts seeing himself as this agent of some greater change or having some greater role. And so that, again, starts bringing him out of his own, you know, real focus on himself. And then what I think, there are many examples like this, but in some ways maybe the most telling one is that when he finally does leave the wilderness, the British finally pry the French out of the wilderness, and Washington immediately quits and goes back to his plantation in Virginia. And he immediately, within weeks, marries Martha, who's also the richest widow in Virginia. And that immediately sends Washington to the top of the aristocracy. Now he is financially secure. He has plenty of land. together with Martha, lots of slaves. He's established, and this is now he's 27 or 28, and so he's no longer having to thrash around so much to make a name for himself. He does have a name, and also I think that's something deeper and more profound, that I think Martha really brings this sort of sense of emotional support to him in a way that he hadn't had before. She's a very warm person. She's universally liked. She comes across, she's not some big romantic figure, you know, of great first lady, but she's this very warm, hospitable person. And one really gets the sense that she very much supports Washington emotionally and gives him this kind of reassurance, this emotional reassurance that he didn't have in all these years thrashing through the wilderness trying to make a name for himself.
Wow.
But unfortunately, we'll never know the answer for sure, because soon after Washington died, after George died in 1799, Martha burned all their correspondence. Mm. And so we'll never really know that.
We would give just about anything to be able to see those. A last quick question. What would you say are the most important characteristics of the wilderness and being in the wilderness that contribute to what you have been describing as kind of this crucible of difficulty from which emerges the George Washington that we now all recognize? Is it the sort of the sense of kind of deprivation or the uncertainty of what lies around the next bend? Is it the remoteness from figures of authority? What is it especially about this particular wilderness that we are talking about? What are the characteristics most crucial to the shaping of this particular narrative?
Wow, that is a really good question. I could probably write a book on that alone. I touch on some of it as we go through this book, but you're really honing in on things. A couple of things that you mentioned, which I think are very much the characteristic of wilderness in general, and this one in specific, that have quite a profound emotional impact on humans. That George was, from a plantation society, and he was used to a house where he was attended by servants, and everything was kind of done for him, prepared. Well, you get into a wilderness of any sort, and that just doesn't happen the same way. And although the Brits certainly tried, they'd bring in their servants and their silver trays to serve dinner on and whatnot. But once you're really deep in the wilderness, at least the way I think of being deep in the wilderness, you don't have all those trappings. It's a much more elemental situation you're facing. Just as an aside, the first time George did go into the wilderness on this first frontier surveying party on the edge of the wilderness, he complained that there were no linen tablecloths on the tables in the settlers' homes. So you can see there's a really blatant sense of contrast there. And they were eating I don't think they were using knives and forks. They were not using forks and spoons. They were just using knives. So he considered them really primitive creatures. But anyway, even in that trip, he confronted, the wind and the rain and all sorts of difficulties. So that you end up in a situation where you yourself have to deal with what can be an overwhelming, powerfully hostile in a way situation in weather conditions, and the uncertainties, as you say, which to my mind is a very big factor, the uncertainty of what you might face, and the uncertainties in this case in that Ohio wilderness. I mean, that was like going into the Congo, African Congo, like a British explorers 100 years ago, going into the Ohio wilderness in the 1750s, there were Indian tribes. You didn't know if they were with you, against you. You didn't know what was going to happen. There was uncertainty at every turn. And a final thing that I think is really so profound in the wilderness are there, that there are these forces that make you realize that you are just puny, that they are so much larger than you are. Whether it's the cold, that's, I've written a lot about the power of cold. Washington had some head-on experience with that. It's very humbling. It's you know, you get humbled by those powers. And I think even today, in the news today, you know, we're reading about the volcano in Hawaii spewing lava. And, you know, we think as humans that we are so powerful. And, you know, we have atomic bombs. We can move mountains or whatever we want to do. Well, when the earth shakes like that, starts spewing up lava, there is nothing we can do. That's the power of nature, the power of wilderness. And I think that's an incredibly humbling force for someone who's really faced it head on. Mm.
Well, we learn about all of that and much more, including much about this really crucial and brutal war, the French and Indian War, as it is kind of mistakenly known, a much misunderstood conflict, very important for the history of North America, and very much crucial in, of course, the Revolutionary War that follows shortly thereafter. And, of course, at the heart of both conflicts is the young George Washington. And we learn so much from your fascinating book, again titled Young Washington, How Wilderness and War Forged America's Founding Father, published by Echo, a division of HarperCollins, the author Peter Stark. Peter Stark, thank you for writing yet another marvelous book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Well, thank you, Craig, for another delightful conversation.
I'm very excited about tomorrow's morning show. That's Wednesday. I'm going to be speaking with Robert Stone, director and producer of a magnificent three-part documentary that will be airing on PBS next week called Chasing the Moon, created to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 landing on the moon. It's an incredible series, and it utilizes a great deal of video footage and other artifacts that have never before been seen, or certainly not widely shared with the public. And the documentary lays out a very richly detailed historical context against which the events of Apollo 11 played out. I really hope that you'll make a point of listening to tomorrow's morning show. It's really quite interesting. There'll be no morning show on Thursday, the 4th of July, although I will offer up a morning show with our podcast. I encourage you to subscribe to that, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. On Friday, we'll be back broadcasting The Morning Show, and you will be hearing my interview with Alan Shaun, author of a book called Wish I Could Be There: Notes from a Phobic Life. Alan Shaun, for much of his life, has contended with an array of phobias that have very much curtailed his life, and yet he has found a way to surmount them and live a meaningful life with them. You'll also hear my interview with Adam Waits, the author of The Power of Human, who examines those characteristics that set human beings aside, and he explores in fascinating detail the way in which we can learn to coexist and collaborate with automation and robots and all of that that is radically changing life as we know it. That's on Friday's morning show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions.